Hi, this is Catherine, just dropping in to say hi and to tell you that both Kate and I have newsletters. My newsletter is called Highbrow, Lowbrow, Mediumbrow, and hers is called The Bowerbird. Both are on Substack. We'll put links on the First Time Instagram feed and on our website, and we would love if you would subscribe. Thank you.
Happy summertime, First Time listeners, or happy wintry new year to our listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. My name is Kate Mildenhall, and my co-host here at the First Time podcast, Catherine Collette, and I are both at the beach. Maybe some of you are too, but we wanted to give you some ear happiness over our break. So we've put together our top 10 episodes ever for you to revisit and get you inspired for a new year of writing and reading and creativity. Welcome to our summer series. Happy summer and happy listening. The First Time podcast records on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Kim Scott grew up on the south coast of Western Australia. As a descendant of those who first created human society along that edge of ocean, he is proud to be one among those who call themselves Noongar. His second novel, Benang from the Heart, won the 1999 Western Australian Premier's Book Award, the 2000 Miles Franklin Literary Award, and the 2001 Kate Challis Racker Award. His third novel, That Dead Man Dance, also won the Miles Franklin Literary Award in 2011, the Commonwealth Writers Prize, and the Western Australian Premier's Book Award. Kim lives in Fremantle, Western Australia, and is currently Professor of Writing at the School of Media, Culture and Creative Arts, Curtin University. His latest book, published in 2011, is Taboo. I only read it recently. It blew me away. His writing is so beautiful. I cannot recommend it enough. I was really, really looking forward to talking with him, and I hope you enjoy this chat. We cover key themes in his work, history and identity and culture and language, particularly of his ancestors, the Noongar people. I wanted to make a minor point for clarity. We talk about the informants. I just want to make it clear what that was. There was a Noongar language material collected in the 1930s in Albany, and the informants are the people that that language material was collected from. I hope you enjoy. Welcome, Kim, to the First Time podcast.
Lovely to be here. Thank you.
I have a very minor point to begin with. I really like your bio, in particular, that opening statement, as a descendant of those who first created human society along that edge of ocean, he is proud to be one among those who call themselves Noongar. It made me think that a bio is a real opportunity in some ways. It's something we read a lot, and yours sets a really positive frame. I wondered if it was something that you had thought very much about, or did you just dash it off and send it to your publisher when you were asked for it?
Oh, no, I'm sure I thought about it. I can't remember the process, why I came up with it like this. I think I'm partly alluding to Guns, Germs and Steel. Is it Jared Diamond who talks about whatever we say, it was in Australia, it was Aboriginal people who first created human society there. So I thought it was a way of talking about the millennia, the many generations, been here forever sort of thing, and different way of saying stolen country, et cetera, et cetera.
I like it.
Thank you. Kim, it turned a bit wordy to me when I was listening to
it. Well, I think the thing is you have so many awards, which is something that we will come back to. You've had a lot of success as a writer, but I will start at the start. This podcast is called The First Time, and we really like to get a sense of where people's writing life has begun. Have you always been a writer?
Doodling more than writing. Yeah, I think about my writing as an extension of drawing, you know, the pleasure as a child in pen and paper, certain. And I used to draw nonstop. And as a teenager, I kept a sort of a journal and sort of wrote, I don't think you'd even call it poetry, you know, but that sort of thing, a lot of spaces around the words. And then when I was teaching English, I felt somewhat fraudulent teaching teenagers supposedly to write, and really I didn't know how you went about it in a serious way. So that made me try and get published or take it more seriously. I've always read a lot, so I'm a fan of writers, I suppose.
What sorts of things did you read growing up, and where did your books come from?
I was thinking about this the other day when I was thinking about the ubiquity of devices. I realised I used to read a lot of labels sitting at the dinner table, breakfast table. You know, whatever was in front of me, I'd read. But in a more orthodox way, popular fiction, a lot of comics. I think comics were probably the mainstay of my reading.
Who are your comic? What was your favourite comics? I read comics as a kid.
I don't know. I used to like Mighty Mouse. I don't know where that comes from, just the style of the drawing I liked. The Phantom I used to read a lot of, all the superhero stuff. There was someone called Shadow, I think, an Australian comic. Might have come from the same place as the Phantom. Oh, yeah, anything. Didn't like those British comics with too many words. They didn't have the speech bubbles and they'd have all the words along the bottom. Didn't like them.
Well, it's interesting, though. Comics is a beautiful merging of drawing and writing, isn't it?
It's sort of... Yeah, graphic novels now. Yeah, and very clever sometimes, I think.
So you said that you were teaching and you felt a little bit fraudulent and wanted to get something published. What was the first thing that you had published?
Yeah, I wanted to know how you got published, really. I had no idea. I didn't know any writers. The first thing I got published was a short story. It must have been poetry. I started with poetry. I don't know if I could remember. What particular one? Pub Breakfast was an early one. Our Father was another one. And they were in very small little poetry journals, you know, local writers' clubs publishing, not much more than that, local arts centre. So it would have been poetry. And then I had a short story that was a place getter in a rural newspaper, The Western Farmer, I think. So somewhere in there, I'm not sure which would have been first.
Well, you went on early 80s. Okay, so early 80s, flash forward to 1999, your first book, True Country, came out. Where did the writing of that begin?
I think it was 93, actually, that one came out. I think so. It came out of its concerns are autobiographical, not always its content. Came out of... being a Noongar teacher and being confronted in a way I hadn't been before with racism, an awareness of racism, and thinking about history and identity in a placing oneself in a bigger picture for the first sort of time as a relatively young adult, I suppose. Maybe I was a late developer. Yeah, so very much out of that. What am I doing? What am I meant to be teaching? Where do I come from? That's those sort of notions, very much, I think, and how to story that.
How did True Country, you obviously wrote a manuscript. How did that manuscript come to be a book? What was the pathway to publication?
Yeah, I'm always a little embarrassed remembering this, my lack of confidence, my diffidence. I got it to a state where I thought, I think this is a book, I think this is a novel. They're Fremantle Press, a local regional publishing house, still run a competition, the TJ Hungerford. And the publishing house, the office was a few blocks from where I was living. So I had no idea how to go about the latter stage of publication once you'd written the thing. And I saw an advertisement for their competition, worked out where they were, and just walked into the office and handed over a lever arch file saying, I'd like this entered in the competition, and then got out of there.
Wow.
Very quickly.
So that's very, very brave. I feel like it's, well, we do hear people on the podcast talk about posting it off, but that face-to-face feels more intense for some reason.
I was probably too tight for the postal cop. But the fact that they were, no, it mattered that you could walk in, you know, and it was just all seemed so anonymous, and it was something just to go into a publishing place, you know, that was part of it. And the woman, Helen Garwood, I think, was very, very kind, you know. What's your address? As I was slamming the door. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so what was the experience like when the book came out?
Oh, it was nerve-wracking, I suppose. It's hard for me to remember over this time. Nerve-wracking. I was very complimented by the editing process, notes on one's manuscript and the evidence that someone had read it closely. That mattered a lot. A small book launch, that seemed very grand at the time, because I had very little experience in this with this sort of stuff. It was exciting, and it made me proud. My wife was very happy. You know, the family thought I was very clever. But then it all dies away so quickly. I realised the small publisher, very regional, small print. I was disappointed that there wasn't more money involved. The usual.
So we'll come back to books or talk more about books, but a little detour first. Alongside writing, you have been very involved with others in the Wurlaman Noongar Language and Stories Project. Perhaps to start with, you could talk a little bit about where this project began or where your involvement with it began.
I mentioned before with True Country, it was sort of, you know, identity issues, identity history, how come I'm here sort of thing. And with this the little success that Bearnung got, I realised how few Noongar readers that I had for a book like that.
Can I just say little success? It won the Miles Franklin.
Yes, it won Miles Franklin, yeah. But its success was, without getting pretentious about it, was disturbing when I realised, who am I writing for? And then I realised with many Noongars I knew, the book was sort of like a cultural artefact rather than something to be read. It's out there. It's getting to them. You know, you're speaking to those. That's great. They're circulating it. But people not reading it as such, and it's a difficult novel, partly deliberately so. The next book I did after that was a non-fiction book with a Noongar elder, partly trying to address these sort of issues. Who am I writing for? You know, what's the point? Other than I'm sort of, you know, like it sometimes. And then with that Noongar elder, Kayang Hazel Brown, she was offering me language. She was very interested in rebuilding language and I think consolidating her heritage and sharing it with younger generations to try and fix up things. She thought it was something they needed. So very much from that, and she'd pushed me into positions of responsibility. She'd written out by her father's, in his last few years of her father's life, she'd handwritten a word list, about 500 Noongar words. So clearly she wanted to do something and preserve and rebuild. So and it seemed to matter to me, as against a lot of my literary writing was sort of deconstructing, if that's not too pretentious, some of the most readily available narratives. And it seemed to me, I began to sense that in Noongar language, there was other narratives altogether that weren't so reactive and secondary in a sense, but there was a lot going on. And the idea then, as it grew, as I took on that responsibility, the idea of oneself as an instrument for an old language, and how even in trying to make different sounds, you're reshaping oneself. All that seemed to matter. And I think if I was any good in a literary sense, I'd be able to operate or story or find ways to story with a different audience that books weren't reaching necessarily. So a lot of it, yeah, that's how it began. And then I started looking at archival language sources, and for one of those There was a program, a community program going on to digitise some of it and locate as part of that key descendants of the informants, if that makes sense. There was some material collected in 1930 in Albany that listed the informants. It was in the International Phonetic Alphabet. So I became involved in that, and with the help of Artie Hazel and his siblings, we tracked down key descendants of those informants, and they were all people we and she particularly was related to. So you had, a group of elders. You had trust, each of them carrying bits of language, not all, sometimes contradicted. They contradicted one another in that. And it seemed, and it still seems, an important thing to work with, to try and rebuild stories from that position with a group of people like that that were wanting to work together, that wanted this sort of thing to do, to be done, use it to pull together extended family. And we'd workshop, I'd read out some of this stuff with a group of us around it, have it written out in large letters. We'd all argue about what was right and what was wrong and how you said things. We'd be reminded of other stories in doing that. We'd share, or they, others more than me, would share anecdotes about those informants and other people they remembered that were no longer with us. And so there was trust.
Mm.
It was a very specific heritage. There was another way than what I was of doing what I was trying to explore in some of those early novels, country, history, identity, ways of relating, and all that sort of thing. And since, so that's been going, we've formed it as a not-for-profit, incorporated body that owns copyright for stuff we publish and perform. That seemed to make sense as well, in terms of whatever you call it, sovereign data or authority and ownership. In recent years, we've got something coming up soon to herald this. We've managed to match various what I'd call language artifacts, stories and song in old Noongar language, reconnect it with community, so those descendants of the informants that left it, and most exciting of all, with landscape. So that business of bringing all that together, given our traumatic and fragmented history and heritage, and what might flow from that is really exciting. It's such a buzz.
Well, this landscape element is so fascinating, and it makes so much sense. But in the context of having, say, studied history at university, you read or learn about history as linked to a place, but this feels like a much more specific anchoring to place.
Yeah. One of the picture books we've published, Tortbalkart, Dog His Head, or it's literally the word for seal. There's areas of country where the dogs leap through fire, roll down a hill into the ocean. So we found that place. There's a place where a Noongar man's wait, the seals come to him at a further along the coast. And there's a great granite head looking out over a slope, the lower part of which the rocks have eroded to look like seals looking up at him. So when you touch on that, it's a creation story. And so you, how can we use language and community brought back to this place to activate that heritage, to activate the spirit, really? What an ancient language like this, so melded to landscape, one and the same. You begin to think, is this part of how we manage country, and it's in an area infamous for historical massacre, killings, and infamous for the extent of clearing. So it's endangered country. And then this little national park in the centre of it, to find these things, to be part of bringing these things together. It's tremendous, I think. And there's a lot going on that it's hard to put into words. And Noongar is probably the best words to put some of this stuff into. If I can go on in just raving like this, as part of this sort of research in this same area, I spent the night with a cousin of mine, and I've formed this into a short story and a film script. We spent the night at the homestead where this massacre began, this historical massacre. And that seemed foolhardy in some ways, particularly given that for a lot of Aboriginal people, this is an area known as taboo because of the killings that went on there. But my cousin said to me before we went to sleep, "What are other people, other Noongars, going to say about us staying the night here?" And I remember saying to him, "Look, if we are connected with what happened here, they'll be happy to see us back, surely." And when we left the next morning, as we drove out through this creek, these two mallee hens, quite an endangered bird, came out and stood in front of the car, so we had to stop the car. A little later, after we got going again, a big group of emus galloped, if that's what they do, across the front of the car, and we had to stop again. When we got out to the gate leading onto the bitumen road, there was an eagle on each gatepost. So you're making eye contact with these birds, winding your window down as you approach, make eye contact before then they took off. So that sounds new agey and mumbo jumbo, but I think that was a message that we were doing the right thing. So I've since taken a busload of Noongars back to that same property and met with the people that own it, trying to confront and deal with issues of history and so on. So thanks for listening to all that. I don't know how I got that far.
It reminds me of taboo.
Taboo is very much informed by this sort of work, yeah.
Which is sort of interesting, taboo. I was looking for the right word to talk about it. I think they sometimes, or in some analysis or reviews, they talk about a magic realism sort of element. But that's kind of what you're talking to, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, what I just talked about, yeah, if you wrote that as fiction, that'd be magic realism, but it was real.
yeah, that's right. It's sort of this. Yeah. It feels like this sort of noticing of whatever you call it is a part of your life experience, and it finds its way into fiction.
And this reconnecting with and consolidating this old heritage is part of helping you see those things and possibly activate those sort of experiences or those sort of possibilities. One can't be sure about this, but there's little things that happen. And you get hijacked by new age narratives and whatever too, talking like this.
Linking again with taboo, and maybe this links with the language work as well, it feels like you offer a pathway forward that your work acknowledges and talks to and lets a reader sort of experience or learn about the violence and the trauma and all of these sorts of things. But there's an element that also feels hopeful. Was hope, say, in the case of taboo, but also in other books, is hope something that's important to you to include in your work?
Yes, I think it is. Hope and escape. Escape and hope. Part of the writing is probably motivated by some sense of the inadequacy of, or the tawdry, cheap, threadbare nature of the readily available discourses or narratives to talk about my experience and family history without even extending it beyond that. So hope, is an escape from that trap that one is in and the limitations of a narrative, historical narrative that offers guilt and victimhood. Mm. Where do you go with that? You know, it's a little battle going on. Mm. How are you going to win there? So there has to be, for me, the hope is about some other narrative, some other way of storying this, which there's a future for and builds on the past. I think.
You mentioned before that Noongar narratives are less reactive.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, they're not starting. They don't start the old yarns. They don't start with colonisation, for instance. So they're not reactive in that way. They're self-assured, confident. There's great generosity of spirit in lots of them, I think. So yes, they're from before the context and strictures and structures of colonization. That's what I mean. They're not reactive.
Mm.
Some of them, even that I'm aware of from archives, let alone oral history, contain colonial experience within that frame. And that becomes really interesting as well. There's a Noongar song collected by Daisy Bates from along the south coast, east of Albany, which in colonial times was sometimes known as King George Town or King George Sound. And I don't think I can remember it all. Demunga, Manga, Kichumia, Bonak, Warabin, King George Town. So you've got this Noongar language, Noongar cultural frame, and it mentions a colonial place where things are becoming bad, it's saying. My eye is cutting through the bush toward King George Town, Albany, to where things are becoming bad. That's a really interesting narrative. It's beginning to move into that sort of reactive space, but it's holding it all within that Noongar language frame, whereas if you haven't got that, you're just reacting or complaining, being an activist, being polemical, but it hasn't got the strength that you have if you can connect to that pre-colonial narratives and heritage. And there's orbits, there's characters who orbit, as Noel Pearson would, I think, say, away from home, trusting their heritage to take enormous risks and then return enriched and better able to contribute. That's a one way of paraphrasing some common narrative sort of arcs that are there. And I find that really interesting. It's not being trapped in the past. It's not being reactive. These are things we can really, that's a very modern narrative, I would think. So all that becomes interesting. And then how does that connect to the published literary work? I'm never quite sure, but I don't like it to be an easy movement because, again, you get hijacked by convention and genre and other demands of literature, I think.
On the theme of language, in the afterword to Taboo, you write, "There is little literal Noongar language in Taboo. I would have it speak to a wider audience and do more than posture difference."
Yeah, that's a clumsy little phrase, that, isn't it? That again is about audience. And I, in some of my earlier novels, I'd used Noongar language, probably at an earlier stage of working with it and sensing that it's such a marker of identity and difference, I suppose. There's something else going on. But in Taboo, I thought, well, hang on, what's the point of doing that? In an age where marginalised and diverse writers will be pulled into the fold, I think. Do I want to just feed that or posture that? I want to get right to people's interiors. So what are you doing when you're using a language that no one's going to understand? That's what I wondered about. But and it's a very provincial language. Yeah, it's just particular. I work with the dialect of Noongar, so it's just a little bit of the southwest corner of WA, and the books go much further than that. So it was just about wondering what am I doing, and increasingly it seems to me that we've moved from the attempted destruction and certain denigration of Aboriginal heritages to, in so-called enlightened circles, the recognition that this is, as I sometimes say, a major denomination in the currency of identity and belonging. So a little settler colony, insecure, riddled with all sorts of anxieties and neuroses. This is going to heal. Well, this is what we need, mm-hmm. you know. And what about all those in community I know? What about all those Noongars that need to, I would say, need to reconnect with that? And they're going to be left behind because entitled, privileged readers can pick up language once it's readily available, can pick it up quicker. You know, they've got different skills and different living circumstances. Whereas a lot of, with all due respect, you know, dysfunctionals, perhaps, that I know, they'll get left behind. And that's the power relationship in history repeating itself. Same old, same old. So it's, I might be wrong with this, and I know I'm going against the grain a little bit, but that's largely explains why I chose not to use Noongar language. You want to help incite that interest in it and the valuing of it. You don't want to just sort of hand it over, and nor do I want to be posturing difference for some sort of marketing reason. I want people recognize commonalities and differences, but you got to, and what reading and writing, you know, you create the reality through that collaboration of interior lives. So it seemed to be putting up a certain pattern of letters. that must be one of those Aboriginal languages or something. You're not really getting to people, you know, I thought, but I might be wrong.
Well, I think one of the effects of that is that probably the most the book that stands, one of the words that stands out in the book as contested is this word massacre, because there are people in the book that are comfortable to use that term, and then there are people that are, you know, the sort of the landowners who are very, really shy away from it and say that they don't want to use that term. I think that's an interesting effect.
Yeah. And as I said earlier, taboo is informed a lot by this Willem and Noongar language and stories. And there'd been a memorial a few years ago, about 5 years ago, I think, that we'd put up to do with the massacre, Kokonera massacre. And there was lots of those issues coming up. So I'm partly processing, lived experience in that sort of space, I guess. Mm.
John Fielder said of you that Kim Scott is an important figure in Australia today because of his creative quest to open up new and different ways of being Black and to provide a language for that which is otherwise unutterable. Does this resonate for you, this idea of opening up new and different ways to be Black? And what does it mean?
Well, yeah, I think it resonates. Perversely enough, though, what about with Ben Ungrago? The narrator goes, I may well be the first successfully white man born in the family line. That's partly to begin a deconstruction of some of the most readily available ways of being Black, a failure, not a real Black, you know, those sort of things, all that identity, anxiety. So the deconstruction, I don't like that phrase, but it's good enough at this moment, you know, the dismantling some of those stronger, readily available narratives, and then coming up with something else that doesn't speak from those sources. The archives themselves are full of negative representations, probably stemming from insecurity and so on, I think. And then, as I was saying before, some of those older stories of the orbiting, taking on new experience, being everything you possibly can, they don't normally fit within the narrow articulations of Aboriginality and our wider society, I don't think. Again, in Bairnung, I have at one stage the fella standing in front of a mirror. It's a bit of a cheap trick. We know this. Didn't feel it at the time, though. And seeing himself reflected in a range of representations of Aboriginality, the rodeo fella, the boxer, the country and western singer, the drunk inevitably. So they're ways of being Black, if you like, that don't do justice to the reality of what it is, and limit and narrow down the possibilities. Whereas I think, from what I know of history, I think Noongar people were and are really generous and really spiritual and confident and ready to take on, ready to improvise, be agile in that way, and to take on new experience because of their that old, because of their traditions. And I think that's, there's some interesting ways of being black in there, rather than, again, the what's given to you. And they're, it's a limited sort of repertoire. One is permitted to play, I think. The resistance warrior is another rather conventional one that for me often seems to be just some other version of the Gallipoli thing, you know, the some sort of glory in defeat or something. And I think there's...
It's a really interesting comparison.
You know, I mean, there's just notions, you know, and perhaps if I unpack them, they're flawed, but this is a sort of intuitive reaction and why I say things like that. There's, I, you know, Noongar people that I know should be in leadership positions, it seems to me, despite the damage and trauma of history. There's enormous real quality in what is made available to one from that ancient heritage in place and ways of being together that we can consolidate and strengthen and will inform our possibilities for being black or for being, you know, an inhabitant of this particular country, this place.
Kim, you've had a lot of success as a writer, among other things, twice winning the Miles Franklin. Do you have a favourite failure, or is there a time when things didn't work?
There are many times when things don't work. I do not have a favourite failure. I do my very best not to dwell upon failure. No, it is productive, but always in, it can be productive, but always in retrospect. I'm afraid I don't feel psychologically strong enough to dwell on failures at the moment, though. Sorry about that.
That's all right. We will continue to pick your brain, though. We have a lot of listeners that listen to this show that are writers. What is the best advice that you have in relation to writing?
Some version of discipline, I think. You know, it's lock the door, chain yourself to the desk, you know, certain number of words per day or certain amount of time. You've got, and I say all these things because I have to get something down on the page before I can go any further. And I find that difficult more and more, it seems. So that seems to me primary, some version of discipline. You've got a way of getting words on the page.
That's good advice. Final question, debut book recommendation. It can be any place, any author, any genre.
Yeah, what came to mind, and at another time something else might come up. I think I won the Booker Prize, The Bone People. Kerry Hulme, Hulme. I'm not sure how you'd pronounce that. New Zealand writer. So I'm pretty sure that's a debut novel. And it struck me when I first read it many years ago, and I've read it since.
Oh, you've gone back and reread.
That's Yeah.
A dual commendation, I think. Mm. Kim Scott, thank you for your time and for your wisdom today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please share the love on socials at The First Time Pod on Insta and Twitter, or by leaving a review wherever you listen. To support our work in season 6, you can become a patron via patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast, or check out our work and upcoming events and workshops on katemildenhall.com or katherinecollette.com. We'll be back with brand new episodes in March 2023.